Hi, it's Mike. It's Saturday, the Saturday show. And we do one from the vault and one from the week on Saturdays. We sometimes break format. It's our show. We could do it. But we're going to stick to the format. And the one from the week was a fun segment we did on the full Ginsburg. It's self-explanatory. I mean, after you get into it, you'll understand it. Kind of a delight. Someone described it as old school gist until we got very serious. And even though that was a great segment from this week, if I do say so myself, most of the week was taken over by contemplation of an extremely important event, really an extremely important period as we are in COVID's wake. And the book by that name, by Francis Lee and Stephen Macedo, was a full show interview. And then we did another interview and then I contemplated it because we need to reexamine. I got some pushback now with what Trump is doing. Is now the time? I say it's always the time to reexamine extremely important decisions and try to learn from them. Also try to recognize that the tumult that they cause might have in fact played a role in the fact that Donald Trump is back in office. So in one of my interviews, the authors of this book mention Paul Offit, who is a top doctor at Children's Hospital. And I said, I had Paul Offit on the show. And a great thing about Offit was we really went over what he got right, what he got wrong, how he thinks about it. In fact, as I recalled it, it was a long interview. We did a two-part interview. And part two with Offit, as conducted in 2021, was to ask him about what he got wrong about the coronavirus. Interviews I heard him do in the early days, interviews that he's rethought, some things that he hasn't. And we aired that as its own interview. I posited that this would be gentle pushback. I mean, it was sort of gentle. I asked him all the tough questions. Now, here's what's interesting. I think if you listen to that interview from 2021 and think about everything that Lee and Macedo and David Zweig, who also wrote a book, and if you've been following the mistakes that were made, the mistakes that were excusable, the excuses that we're using, I think overusing for that, which was excusable, a lot of what I was asking Offit about in 2021, we've even progressed past then. So it does seem that some of Offit's original inclinations about the virus, we don't need a lockdown and it will probably have a low death toll, was both right or wrong. It was kind of pressing him on issues based on the best of what we knew in 2021. It's interesting to look back about how much of what I was pressing him on, I'd even agree with today. So I don't want to turn this into a Mobius strip. I do want to turn it into an object lesson in mistakes and owning up to mistakes and contemplating mistakes, which is in general what I think we should be doing even during this tumultuous time. In fact, especially during this time. So enjoy the full Ginsburg and give a careful listen to my older interview with Paul Offit. Yesterday, we spoke to Paul Offit, professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania, the director of vaccine education at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. So he was on to talk about his book, Overkill, When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far. And that was a good conversation. I commend you to yesterday's show. But in this half of the interview, we talk about coronavirus. And first, I asked him about young patients he was seeing, because we know that children can spread the virus, but it's not very deadly to them. However, there is this new series of symptoms, which looks a little like Kawasaki's disease. It's marked by inflammation. And I asked the doctor if he was seeing children presenting those symptoms. I wanted to now transition to talking a little bit about COVID-19 and the pandemic. First, I'll ask you, there have been reports about how this does show up in children. And in general, children can spread the disease, but they haven't been killed by it. But there is an exception that, you tell me, has it been presenting itself lately, or we've been noticing it lately, where there is this inflammation in the body that looks like Kawasaki disease before we went on in front of the microphones. We were talking a little bit about this. Tell me what you've been seeing with that presentation of coronavirus.
Right. So we've seen a handful of these children in our hospital, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and it's a post-infectious phenomenon. In other words, these children often have no signs or symptoms of COVID-19, none. And then, you know, sort of weeks later, after they've been exposed, presumably, to the virus, they develop this sort of multi-system disease characterized by rash and so-called vasculitis, meaning inflammation of the vessels. And because all organs have blood vessels, therefore all organs are affected. The organ that is most severely affected is the heart. The two arteries that supply the heart can become inflamed. And with that, you can suffer essentially a heart attack and death, which has happened now to about four or five children in the United States. Again, as a general rule, the COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2, the virus, spares children as a general rule. I mean, I think there's fewer than 15 children in the United States who've died, as compared to, say, 160 children who died of influenza this year. So it tends to generally spare children, but there is this unusual syndrome. This is a weird virus. I mean, it's a bat coronavirus that just recently made its debut in the United States, and we are learning as we go.
Yeah, if there wasn't the entire pandemic we're dealing with, but if, say, this was only showing up in the rare cases in children that you've been seeing, would that even be, I mean, we're insane about the health of our children, so maybe the answer is yes, but would that even be a national conversation? Would it be concerning parents as much as it is now? Because I think in the beginning with coronavirus, people who are at least informed said, well, at least it isn't affecting children, though they could spread it to others. Now I'm hearing from parents, ooh, this is a new wrinkle. Now we've got to be really worried about the effects of coronavirus.
It's still very rare. I mean, you're still talking about maybe 100 children total in the United States who've been affected by this, and I think fewer than five who've died from it. But so it's still extremely rare. You're still more likely to die from influenza in this country than from this virus as a child, as someone less than 18. But but it is worrisome. I mean, it's a new wrinkle to this weird, weird virus.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you about how your thoughts on the virus have changed, because I randomly was driving in my car in early March and I heard you on the Sirius show, which was dedicated to medical professionals. That's run by NYU Langone. And in that show, and we do have the clip, you were, I don't want to say dismissive, but the context you put it in is against the flu, which a lot of people were saying, and you found the flu to be much more dangerous. And you also said you don't understand why we're quarantining. So how did you, I mean, I assume you've changed your mind about that, but you tell me.
Yeah, in two ways. I think, first of all, I still thought at the time that there could be a more sort of surgical way of doing this, which is to say, protect nursing homes. You know, older people should stay home. Anyone who's even mildly ill should stay home. Anyone who, who's exposed to someone who's mildly ill in their house should all stay home. Because again, I thought this was going to be such a huge hit to our economy. I mean, I thought early on, I predicted as many as a 20% loss of our workforce. It could be as high as 30% now, and it could be even higher than that. So, and you know, it's we're going to be digging out from this for years. I thought there's a targeted way, but I think in the end, I think you couldn't trust that people were going to do that. And I think Dr. Fauci was right. Just scare the hell out of people and make us all stay home. The other thing I think I was wrong about, because flu causes typically it can cause 65,000 deaths a year. I never thought we'd be that high because wrongly, I assumed that we would be similar to other countries. I mean, as it turns out, we're 4% of the world's population and 30% of its deaths. I mean, we've done much worse in our country than most other countries. I think of the 240 countries in this world, we're 231st in terms of deaths per million. I never imagined we would be that bad. So I was wrong on both those counts.
Now, I want to play a clip, and I swear this isn't a gotcha. I loved your book. I've loved our conversation so far, but I want to ask you an implication, but I have to play this so the audience hears. Daniel, do you have that?
You know, we have, by CDC estimates, between 18,000 and 45,000 deaths from influenza this year. We have 14 deaths from this virus, and people are treating this like it's a viral apocalypse, and I don't see it. I don't understand the quarantining, which I think is probably going to do very little to stop spread, given that there's a tremendous base of infection, i.e. asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic, that you're not going to identify that's going to cause spread. I mean, this is in the community. It's going to spread. If somebody comes into our hospital and has COVID-19 as compared to influenza, we treat the COVID-19 differently. And I just don't see, I honestly don't understand why. I think we've done a bad job of how we've educated the public about this because we've scared them to death.
And so,
absolutely, I mean this sincerely, not in the spirit of a gotcha, but as a scientist, when you hear that and you do an assessment, what occurs to you? What thoughts run through your head?
Yeah, what occurs to me is I probably shouldn't talk for things where you get to record it, because then you can see how you're wrong. I mean, I was wrong. I think initially when this virus came into the country, the thinking was that it was that its reproducibility index, meaning the number of people you would infect during a day, was similar to flu, which is to say two. You would infect roughly two people a day. And I didn't understand why we were treating this virus differently, given that it was spread by small droplets like flu is spread, and given that it had a reproducibility index similar to flu. Why were we treating it so differently than flu? And the answer was, I was wrong. And we were all wrong. I mean, it doesn't have a reproducibility index of two. It has a reproducibility index somewhere closer to six. Because it, unlike flu, it's not just spread by small droplets. It's also spread by so-called really small droplets, meaning micro aerosolization. So those droplets can hang in the air for 14 to 18 minutes, meaning people don't have to have direct contact with you. They just have to be in your airspace within 10 or 15 minutes of your being there. That's a little more like measles than it is like flu. And I think that's just something we found out. Also, there is a so-called fecal-oral component to spread, so it's like norovirus. You know, and I think there were some early indications of that with seeing the virus on cruise ships, nursing homes. That's very norovirus-like. And so I think, you know, again, we learned as we went. I'm listening to myself say that, and I get how I said that then, based on what we knew then, but I think we've learned more as we've gone. So therefore, what I said was dead wrong.
But also, I do think that the lesson that we had learned again and again and again with bird flu, H1N1, even Ebola, is that there's often an element of absolute panic, and the panic can do more harm than good. And so it seemed like that was the important point to emphasize. Governor Cuomo said the same thing. I think the fear could do more harm than good. But the problem is, when you're wrong about the fear or the panic being worse than the disease, it makes it look like you underplayed it. And I don't know if you have any thoughts, as someone who communicates about public health, what's the best way to strike that balance?
Well, again, I do think that we are going to, there's two parts of this public health disaster. I mean, the first is the suffering and the hospitalization and death caused by the virus. I do think that by doing what we did, completely shutting down without sort of, I do think we could have done this in a more surgical way. I mean, in the Northeast, half the deaths are in nursing homes. So yeah. You know, that could have been a more targeted strategy, meaning make sure that, you know, that you, if you're going to do testing, and we were terrible at doing testing in this country, you know, make sure you do the testing there. No one can walk into that nursing home until they're tested. I mean, really try and isolate those, and you would have prevented as many as half the deaths in the Northeast, where about half the deaths in the country occurred. So I do think that the targeting strategy was not a ridiculous idea, because the second part of this public health disaster is what you're about to see, which is massive joblessness associated with, no doubt, massive homelessness and all the public health disasters that come with massive homelessness, like food insecurity and domestic violence and child abuse and depression and suicide, etc. That's round two. And I do think if we'd done a little better in round two, especially with testing, we wouldn't be in as bad of a position we're at. We're like one of the worst countries in the world in terms of death per million. We were terrible about the way we handled this.
Do you think there's something that affects others in your field such that they can't do what you just did, listen to what you said and said, I got it wrong, now let's try to be right? Because I do see a lot of and hear a lot of people, medical professionals, just digging their heels in and not being able to do that.
No, I think you have to learn as you go. I mean, it's, you know, science, medicine, nature is humbling. And I think, you know, you have to be open-minded to the fact that you might be wrong. So I think I was certainly not right about those things that I said early, but, you know, I'm willing to learn as I go, which in some ways is the theme of this book. I think, you know, we as doctors do learn as we go. I mean, there were things I learned as a pediatrician when I was training in the late 1970s, early 80s that were, you know, sort of taught as gospel that were wrong. And so we have to change. And I think that's sort of part of this book. You're trying to, you know, say, look, here are the data showing that a lot of the things that we're doing, we shouldn't be doing. I think the most surprising thing to me was heart stents. I mean, heart stents don't work. And you know, you think this makes perfect sense, right? Someone just had a heart attack, for example, or they had angina, or meaning a heart chest pain, because one of the two arteries that supply their heart is blocked, say, more than 70%. And the area that where that was damaged beyond that was exactly the area that was being supplied by that artery. So wouldn't it make sense to put a stent in there that opens up that clogged area? Wouldn't that make sense? And there was a study done where they actually did sham stenting, meaning, you know, they pretended to put a stent in half the patients, or they put a stent in the other half, and then they made sure that they did as good as they could in terms of medical treatment, meaning lower the bad cholesterol levels, made sure you kept the blood pressure normal, meaning for people who had high blood pressure, and there was no difference between the two groups. So why would that be true? And now we know that big heart artery also supplies smaller and smaller arteries, which were also blocked, and you weren't opening that up. So I think that if there's anything I do in this book that probably threatens an industry, it's that.
And finally, did you ever think that we would get to this point in this country where we would be having a debate, a relatively uninformed debate, about the potential efficacy of hydroxychloroquine?
Yeah, I know. So I think what Donald Trump initially said was that hydroxychloroquine was going to be the greatest breakthrough in the history of medicine. Didn't work out that way. I mean, it turns out that there's been now three prospective placebo-controlled studies showing that it doesn't in any sense lessen your risk of going to the ICU or lessen your risk of going to the morgue. What it does do, though, 10% of people had to drop out because it causes heart toxicities, arrhythmias. So no, it's not the wonder drug it was claimed to be. It was an example of kind of the executive branch co-opting science.
Uh-huh. So you're saying the discovery of antibiotics and then maybe germ theory are still one and two and haven't been displaced.
Right. Not yet.
Not yet. The name of the book is Overkill. The author who I've enjoyed talking to is Paul Offit. When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far, he's the director of Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now the spiel. So as we discussed up top, on Sunday, Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen appeared on every show. Well, I mean, not every show, not the NBA postgame shows, but all the what they call the Sunday shows. The topic was the detention of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. It's a serious topic, and one hesitates to use the somewhat flippant phrase apply to whenever a guest hits every single Sunday show. But that phrase is the full Ginsburg. Ginsburg was William Ginsburg, Monica Lewinsky's lawyer, in the first year and a half of that scandal. And they say he was the first to do the full complement of Sunday shows. But really, are we sure? Did anyone ever go back to check to see if Dean Rusk was one time on Face the Nation, Meet the Press, and ABC's predecessor to This Week? Remember this one?
From wherever thoughtful people search for answers to the issues of the day, ABC News presents the award-winning interview program, Issues and Answers.
Putting issues right there in the title. Very solid, very proper, very post-war. So I was researching the full Ginsburg, and there is a website that tracks it. It's on Wikipedia, didn't take me much to find it, but since Ginsburg first executed the full Ginsburg, here are some full Ginsburg fun facts. There have been 38 full Ginsburgs since the first Ginsburg. The second full Ginsburg, the Buzz Aldrin of full Ginsburgs, was Rick Lazio. Remember him? Ran for Senate against Hillary Clinton. Want to guess who has the most full Ginsburgs? This is going to be a trivia segment, by the way, so I'll present it as trivia. Trivia, who has the most full Ginsburgs? Well, on February 14th, 2016, and February 21st, 2016, this current member of the cabinet, who is a three-time full Ginsburg, did back-to-back full Ginsburgs, his first and second full Ginsburg. I'll give you the topic. Who would have done that in February of 2016? His second place comeback in South Carolina in the primary there. All right, let's go to the tape.
Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. Senator Rubio, welcome back to Meet the Press, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. Okay, sorry about that. Let me start with how you feel about this win, this second place finish last night. You had every major endorsement that you could have had, and yet you still finished a distant second in South Carolina. How do you look at this as a positive and not a negative?
And Marco Rubio answered, I don't know, maybe in 9 years, I'll get a gig working for the guy. Couple more full Ginsburg trivia questions. So since Hillary Clinton talked about her presidential run in a full Ginsburg in 2007, which, by the way, that didn't take, but there have been only four female full Ginsburgs. Cabinet secretaries Kathleen Sebelius and Janet Napolitano were part of a government panel doing the full Ginsburg on the same day, May 9th, 2009, to talk about what? Do you remember what might have been the very, very pressing topic to get not one but two cabinet secretaries? Maybe a hint is one's Department of Homeland Security, the other's Health and Human Services. What would they have been talking about May of 2009? Here's George Stephanopoulos with the answer.
The swine flu, it continues to spread, but there are signs that the outbreak is smaller and less severe than first feared.
Now, here is my final full Ginsburg Final Jeopardy. So since Hillary Clinton 2007, Sebelius and Napolitano talking about swine flu in 2009, there have been 26 full Ginsburgs. The breakdown is 24 men, 2 women. Name the 2 women. Here are your hints. One was talking about her presidential bid in 2011. The primary would be in 2012. She was getting ahead of it. The other was to discuss Benghazi in 2012. All right, that one I think you could get. You know, the person who talked about Benghazi and that film Innocence of Muslims, and this became a point of dispute. She blamed what we've come to call Benghazi mostly on the film. Here she is on Face the Nation doing that.
What our assessment is as of the present is, in fact, what it began spontaneously in Benghazi as a reaction to what had transpired some hours earlier in Cairo, where, of course, as you know, there was a violent protest outside of our embassy sparked by this hateful video.
And that is Susan Rice. The other female post-swine flu full Ginsburg gal. And what a gal. She ran for president in 2012 race. Here she was on Meet the Press, host David Gregory, hosting then, confronting her with her own words.
During a speech that you gave in 2004 at an education conference, you spoke openly and in detail about gays and lesbians. And I want to play just a portion of that speech and have you react to it.
It's a very sad life. It's part of Satan, I think, to say that this is gay. It's anything but gay. It leads to the personal enslavement of individuals. Because if you're involved in the gay and lesbian lifestyle, it's bondage.
I mean, it could be a life spent flogging or spanking or just cuddling in cups of chamomile tea because you know nothing of gay people. Michelle Bachmann, despite your many Ginsburg, you are talking out of your hat. But I hope you, just listener, today more than yesterday, know a lot more about the full Ginsburg and possibly a lot more than you ever hoped to know. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara, Michelle Peskis, CBSO of Peachfish Production. Ingrid Green does our Instagram and so many of our social media. Umpru, Jeepru, Dupru, and thanks for listening.